Yesterday was Wall Street's worst day in 2.5 years. The Dow fell 634 points. If you are frightened by the performance of the stock market yesterday and the tough economic news in general lately, we do have some help on the way coming up on this edition of On Your Money. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 8 minutes past 8 o'clock on this Tuesday, August the 9th. Financial planner Kevin McKinley is here to talk with you about how you can take control of your spending, saving, and investing. And you can join in with your personal finance questions at 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Kevin McKinley is a certified financial planner, managing member of McKinley Money, LLC, and he joins us from our studios in Eau Claire. Good morning, Kevin. Oh, I have pushed the wrong button. I have pushed the wrong button again. Good morning, Kevin.
Good morning, Joy.
Go on vacation a week and you just forget how things operate around here.
Yeah, I want to talk to you about that.
I know, too many vacations. You know,
well, there's a lot of glitz and glamour that comes along with being the co-host of On Your Money. The Hollywood parties, the trips to Paris, all of that. But there's also a certain responsibility that, especially during times of economic crisis, we need you at your post.
All right.
So
I'm staying
put. Let's not let this happen again.
I know. I'm staying put. I come back from vacation and look what happens. You know, Wall Street goes through the bottom there. It's been really a rough week or two with the economy and Wall Street and investment markets. So I understand today you're going to help us calm down a little bit and learn how to survive and even thrive, no matter how frightening our financial future may seem.
Actually, my internet access has been off for a couple of weeks. If you could just give me a quick update. I assume everything's fine now that the debt ceiling was settled.
You're right. It's all okay now.
Okay, yeah, well, good.
Yeah, what's with that? I thought the debt ceiling agreement was going to stave off a downgrade in the credit. Rating.
It was actually what led up to the debt ceiling agreement that really caused a trigger in the downgrade and all of the other issues. When they talk about the curse about may you live in interesting times, I'm really ready for boring. I'm ready to just, you know, not have to turn the computer on and let the cobwebs go to the buttons. I'm fine with that. The debt ceiling agreement provided a lot of relief. It wasn't what a lot of people hoped it would be, but it did say, okay, at least we have an agreement. We can raise the debt ceiling and the government continue to operate. But in between that agreement and yesterday, there have been plenty of struggles out of Europe. Germany, Italy, and France appear to be teetering more on the brink of financial troubles than they were several weeks ago. There have been lots of negative economic announcements about jobless numbers in industrial production. The housing numbers haven't been good. And the stock market, as measured by the Dow Jones Industrial Average, was down about 10% over 2 weeks' time. Then late Friday afternoon, which always be suspicious of news that comes out on a Friday afternoon, especially during the summer, Standard & Poor's lowered their rating on United States government debt from AAA to AA+, and said they're putting them on the watch as negative, which means they may be downgrading it further if conditions don't improve. Well, that wasn't taken very well by the markets, and in Monday's action, the Dow teetered around a few hundred points down and then ended the day down 600 points. Not even one of the top 20 worst days in terms of percentage drops, but definitely frightening for any investor out there.
So was the downgrade from Standard & Poor's really that big of a deal?
Yes and no. Yes, in the sense that they've been making this rating on the United States government debt for 70 years, and for 70 years the government has always had a AAA rating. And Timothy Geithner, the Treasury Secretary, lost whatever credibility he has left when he said a few weeks and months ago that there was no risk that the United States would lose their AAA rating. And there are plenty of other extra effects on top of this, because when the United States loses a AAA rating, they also can affect the ratings of municipalities and corporate bonds, et cetera, all on down the line. But it also wasn't a big deal because, first of all, Moody's, the other largest independent rating agency, kept the government's, the U.S. government's rating at AAA. Standard & Poor's, shortly after making this downgrade, was called on the carpet by the Treasury and the White House because they found a $2 trillion error. Just $2 trillion, but still, you know, they forgot to carry the seven and said, look, you made a $2 trillion error. And they said, well, we're going to make this downgrade anyway. Japan lost their AAA rating in 2002, and if you check yields on Japan government bonds today, they're actually even lower than United States government bonds. They're about 1% on a 10-year bond. And that comes from a couple of things. There's really nowhere else to go for paper money that provides relative safety and liquidity. There aren't any other countries out there that are doing much, much better than the United States and Japan, et cetera, who can handle the trillions of dollars that need to go someplace to be kept in store. And actually, even after the downgrade and yesterday, interest rates went down because investors generally bid government bond prices up.
So, Kevin, what are the potential solutions to these current conditions?
There is some economic aspect to the problems and the downgrade. Jobs and housing just isn't improving at all. We're still at about a 9% declared unemployment, and most people will tell you that number is actually artificially low. New and existing sales of houses aren't any better than they were a year or two ago and don't look to get any better. But this is really a political crisis. It's about austerity versus spending. And actually, the language in the Standard & Poor's announcement when they did downgrade the debt concentrated at least as much on the, quote, extremely difficult political negotiations. And it actually carried more weight than the United States economic conditions. So Standard & Poor's was saying, hey, you people got to get your act together. You either have to cut spending or you have to raise taxes or both. But some way we're more disappointed in what you're doing politically than really what the economic situation is. And because we're coming up on a major election year in less than 18 months, it's unlikely that those tough measures will be taken anytime soon.
You know, Kevin, the front page of the State Journal, stock market in free fall, and another one, stocks nosedive amid global fears. What are you telling people who are freaking out over this uncertainty and volatility?
Were those headlines by any chance accompanied by a photo of a younger to middle-aged white guy in a trading vest and glasses, like with his hands on his face, grimacing?
You must be looking at the same picture. No, I'm just kidding.
I'm not.
That's
it's
hilarious.
Such a phenomenon of journalism. There's actually a couple different blogs out where all they do is have pictures that they've captured from the wire services or wherever of traders grimacing, holding their faces in their hands. It's an entire blog devoted just to pictures of
That's hilarious because there are at least three pictures like that on the papers I'm looking at right now.
Those guys should get paid, actually. or maybe they should just hire models or stock photo suppliers to just have the guy stand there and be to sit and pinch his nose with his fingers while he wonders what to do next. Well, first of all, we have been through worse. The Dow is probably going to open up somewhere around 11,000 this morning, and we first hit that mark in 1999. So for 12 years, we've been seesawing around 10 and 11,000 on the Dow. We've been as high as 14,000 and as low as almost 6,000 in that time. So we've been through worse. And I am always a little, once you take a step back and get some perspective, I'm a little amazed that we are as worried about the country situation when we've survived the Great Depression and World War II. And even many of us who are alive right now, I was talking with a couple of people who said, you lived during the 1960s when we had some terrible presidential assassinations. We had riots. We had the Vietnam War. And the people said, yeah, I don't know why this feels so different, why this is so much harder for me to stomach. And I said, because you had nothing to lose then.
Yeah.
You know, we've got a lot more to lose now, at least people in their 50s and 60s, and it doesn't look like it's going to get any better. So it will get better. There are going to be solutions to this, but the key salve to all of these problems is time. It just takes a lot of time for it to heal all of the wounds in the economy.
Kevin McKinley is the managing member of McKinley Money, LLC, a registered investment advisor with offices in Eau Claire and Madison. Kevin does not intend to provide personalized investment advice through this broadcast and does not represent that the securities or services discussed are suitable for any investor. You should consult with your own financial advisor prior to making any investment decisions. That being said, if you have a question for Kevin about money matters, about personal finances, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. And it is time now for the On Your Money email bag. And Kay, who says she is an avid listener, says that last year you did a program on loaning money to grandchildren for college. There were some websites that you mentioned with forms that you could download. Do you still have that info? Do we, Kevin?
We do. And Kay is one of our two favorite kinds of listeners. One is avid, the other is rabid.
Yeah.
Those are the only two listeners from whom we'll accept questions. And it's a great question right now, because what's probably going to happen in the near and the longer term is that interest rates on borrowing will rise. Savings rates will probably not rise very much. And it'll be harder for people to borrow. So we have this dichotomy in many families and in the country, for that matter. We have older people with a lot of extra money that they can only get a very low yield, if any at all, on a safe investment. And then we have a younger generation, which not only has a difficult time getting credit, but may have to pay a higher interest rate for it. So it's not only possible, but it can be a good idea to eliminate the middle person, the lender, and lend money directly to people in your family who do need it. But you have to be careful, because there are lots of legal and family pitfalls along the way.
All right. Well, what are some of the legal pitfalls?
A couple areas of concern whenever your money is moving between generations or family members. First of all, the IRS says that you have to charge at least what they term as the applicable federal rate, the AFR. It's usually tied to the term of the loan, and it's very low. But if you charge an interest rate lower than that amount, that can constitute a gift, which can be taxable. Or if you forgive payment, or you forgive the loan entirely, that can also be a potentially taxable gift, and not from an income standpoint, but it can incur a gift tax. You also have to be careful if you are receiving interest, that you declare the interest from the individual, especially if the individual is deducting the interest, if it's for a home mortgage or for a business. And so if you're talking about school loans, you're talking about maybe a car loan or a loan to pay off some credit cards, that's not that big of a deal. When you start talking about a mortgage or a business loan, that's something you definitely should get the help of an attorney or a CPA.
Mm-hmm. What about avoiding the family conflicts?
The whole key is getting it in writing and both parties agreeing to it in advance while things look good and they want to get the deal done. Everything should be in writing, and you need a signature from both parties on it for several reasons. One is to make sure it's a legal document and a binding agreement on both sides, but also to make sure that everyone understands the terms and is fine with them. One issue that comes up is sometimes, you know, parents will say, hey, I'm okay lending some money to my kids, but I don't want to be hassling them on the 18th of the month, knocking on their door and threatening to break their kneecaps because their payments are late. So a couple ways around that, you can set up a service and a system where automatic payments are deducted from the borrower's checking account, you know, say $250 a month every single month on the same day, or the borrower can give the lender, say, 12 checks. All post-dated, and say, you know, go ahead and cash these as the date's near each and every time. And finally, one of the issues that I've seen in helping families accomplish this is there should be some type of understanding that as long as the debt gets paid, the borrower gets to spend money how he or she pleases. And in saying, you know, if I'm making the payments on time, I can still go on a trip someplace. Or if that's not okay, then the lender needs to make sure that that's very clear, that before you go on any trips or you buy a new car or spend this money in ways that I wouldn't have you spending it, I would just assume be repaid first.
So I believe there were a couple of websites that can help people with this.
Yeah, one of the best is loanback.com, LoanBack.com, loanback.com. And then another one is nationalfamilymortgage.com. And both sites, Loanback is the more prominent of the two and the more established one. But both sites allow you to not only create the documents, but set an interest rate, track payments, and get it so it has all the legal basis you need. And we'll have the links to those websites up at our website, onyourmoney.com, later on today.
Kevin McKinley, certified financial planner, managing member of McKinley Money, LLC, is here to answer your personal finance questions during this edition of On Your Money. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network.
Help, I need somebody. Help, not just anybody. Help, you know I need someone.
Well, Kevin McKinley is here with help for your financial questions. He has advice on dealing with this week's economic uncertainty and stock market volatility. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Our first caller is Jackie in Hammond. Hello, Jackie. Oh, I'm sorry. It's Julie. Go ahead, Julie.
Julie, yes. I own some real estate investment of storage units in a smaller town. It has an appraised value as of November of 2010 of $352,000. I have no debt on those buildings, of which there are four of them, and I have been approached by someone to purchase that outright from, and of course, eliminating a realtor in between. My consideration is a number of things, of knowing whether it's wise to sell it at this point or not. I'm considering the tax law of possibly eliminating capital gains in the future. I'm considering the tax law of itemized deductions being reduced for small businesses in the future.
We're going to, I'm sorry, Julie, we might be losing you on your cell phone, so maybe do you just want to know what you should do with these storage sheds?
Yes, I do.
Yeah. Maybe, Kevin, you have questions for Julie while we still have her.
Sure. I would suggest turning the storage shed ownership into another reality show. There's like eight of them out there right now that all revolve around going in and out of storage sheds. I really look upon this as a personal issue. If Julie says, you know what, I'm tired of owning these things, or I think it's the right time for me and my wife to sell them, then I would look at selling them. The capital gains taxes, paying capital gains taxes is almost always a very good problem to have. And in terms of saying, are they going to be eliminated, I would be very shocked in this environment if that were to occur. In terms of losing the itemization for businesses, I would be kind of surprised if that were to occur as well. I'd look upon getting the best price that you can for it and then selling it and deciding what to do with the money instead. I will say this, you're probably, if you want the money to be invested safely, you're going to get maybe 2 to 3% interest on it. So I'm guessing that the yield on that money, whatever proceeds you're able to pull out of the sale, even after taxes, is probably not going to be anywhere near the income that you're generating from the storage sheds. And storage sheds are generally businesses that tend to do better in recessionary times because people don't have enough room in their apartments. They can't get a bigger house for it, so they need some place to store it. In terms of getting the better price for it, if you've been approached for it and you want to sell it to that person, great, go ahead. If you want to make sure you get the most money possible, you might want to list it either with a real estate agent or a business broker to see if there are better offers out there.
Julie, good luck to you. Thank you for calling. Frank in Brule is with us now. Hello, Frank.
Good morning. Say, Kevin, I've got a question pertaining to the thrift savings plan. And I am a retiree of about almost 2 years, and I'm just wondering, due to this economic crisis, if I should be a bit freaked out. Now, I have four separate individual funds in the thrift savings plan, and I'm just wondering if you would consider delving into this to shuffle anything around or what. I haven't gone on into that form of retirement funding, but I'm just wondering, at my age, can I expect to see any rebounding of this, or what possibly could I be looking at?
Sure. It's difficult to do asset allocation over the phone and over the radio, but I will tell you that You know, you have some very low cost and generally pretty good funds in that thrift savings plan option. You will see a rebound. That the question, though, is also how much further down it will go. I saw something yesterday that charted every time we've had a drop of 5% more in the Standard & Poor's index, let's say, generally 6 months later, the markets have been up and in some cases up quite a bit. But the problem is you need to hang on through that. And then also this could go down a lot more. And if you are drawing money out of an account while it is going down in value, that is investment in financial suicide, because it just exacerbates the problem because you're selling shares to pull money out at a low price. So for most people, Frank, the best advice I can give you is try to err on the side of being more conservative rather than trying to make more money to offset any losses that you've received so far. And we're going to talk a little bit about that later on in the show as well. So if you can, please hang on.
All right. Thanks for the call, Frank. Mark in Eau Claire, you're on the air.
Hi, Jay. First of all, I wanted to say I was Kevin's sophomore basketball coach in high school, and he never met a jump shot he didn't like.
I never made a jump shot either, but I took a lot of them.
You liked them.
Okay. Yeah. So I have a question. I have a son that just graduated from college, and I'm wondering if it's always a good idea to consolidate student loans.
Always a good idea. Usually it's a good idea. If it means you can probably, Mark, lock in a lower rate right now and maybe even extend the term.
Okay.
Have you researched it yet to find out if that's the case?
Not really. He just graduated, and we've been starting to get some information coming in about consolidation, and I'm just kind of...
Yeah, it's usually a one-time deal, and this is a site we discussed last week and actually the last couple weeks. You'll want to put in mind, though, especially if they're federal loans, it's IBRinfo.org, IBRinfo.org, and it allows people who either can't get the job they wanted or can't get a job, period, and still have federal student loans out to slow down the payment necessity of each one of those federal student loans. So if he does run into trouble getting income to pay those off, you want to go there. Generally, I think it's a very good idea to consolidate what you can while you can, because unless there's some new government program coming out, interest rates aren't likely to get much lower. So I really do think it's a good idea to at least look into that, lock in the term, lock in the payment, so he knows what he's dealing with going forward. And by the way, for parents who have kids maybe a little younger than Mark's, one of the best ways in these times that you can help kids pay for college costs is to have them borrow whatever they can and then make the repayment on the loans for them after they get out, rather than, you know, forking over $20,000 of money that you maybe can't afford to do over to the university for their freshman and sophomore years. It's usually safer to have them get the loans now while they can and then help the kids repay it rather than paying cash for it. But yeah, Mark, I definitely look into the numbers for it, but I doubt interest rates will get much lower or terms will get much more favorable on those student loan consolidations.
So, Mark, does that sound like a slam dunk?
It does, yeah.
I'm going to blame my producer for that one.
Okay.
So was Kevin a good dribbler, Mark?
He was, yeah. Yeah, I understand he had trouble. He needed a bib when he was really young. No, he was a fine young man.
Yeah, there we go.
Yeah, and then it all went to pot after that, Shirley. I was a fine young man, but as I got older, it all went totally down to hell.
All right, Mark, thanks for the call, and good luck. Are you still a basketball player, Kevin?
I'm a basketball watcher because I have several tall children, and so they're much younger than me and going to be much taller than me, so I'm doing more watching than I am playing.
Well, let's go next to Randy in De Pere. Hello, Randy.
Hey, good morning. How are we doing?
Very good. How are you?
Great, thanks. So my question today is, I have a 9-year-old son, and he studies finances and the economics and things, and he came into $100 as a gift recently, and he's wondering, what should he invest it in for the long term so it's available for college? I'm on the other end of the previous caller.
Did he? It was just a gift. It wasn't money he earned, right?
Right. It was a gift.
Okay. I would say a good mutual fund. And the good mutual fund would be like a Vanguard, something low cost, the Vanguard 500 fund, something that has stocks, but something that's not completely predicated on one company. If you really want it to be in a learning experience, you could have him buy a few shares of McDonald's at a place like ShareBuilder.com. But I guess I'd actually rather have him have the mutual fund so that he can, you know, if he doesn't have a 50% loss just because, you know, the double cheeseburger went to $1.29 or something. So if he wants to learn about it, wants to keep track of it, the mutual fund's the way to go. And you can put it in his name. There are a few tax consequences for it once the money grows to a larger amount. But if it's his money, typically he'll have more investment, if you will, and ownership of it, and he'll tend to pay more attention to it. But I definitely encourage anything that you can do to foster his interest in that.
Great. Thanks a lot. I appreciate it.
Hey, Randy, before you go, is your son interested in radio broadcasting at all?
Oh, he is quite the talker, so either sports radio or talk radio might be in his future as well.
Oh, there we go. I also thought he sounds like he's, you know, he might be a young Kevin McKinley with his interest in investing at 9 years old. So
that might be a possibility, too.
You never know.
Yeah, some people say there's already too many Kevin McKinleys, so one more really won't help anything at all.
All right. Thanks, Randy, for the call. Kevin McKinley, certified financial planner, managing member of McKinley Money LLC with offices in Eau Claire and Madison, is here to answer your personal finance questions and here to offer you some advice on how you can take control of your spending, saving, and investing, especially during the recent economic uncertainty. 1-800-642-1234. There's now an open line for you. Been busy, but now we can take your call at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. It's time now for our Smart Assets segment of the program. The past few weeks and years may serve as a wake-up call to reevaluate our spending, our saving, and our investing. And Kevin, we're going to take a look at saving and investing in this week's Smart Asset segment. What should we be considering?
Joy, I have this on pure anecdotal evidence, but and you may be surprised to hear this. I know I was. Not every single person in Wisconsin listens to every single episode of On Your Money.
I don't know what's wrong with them.
I don't know either. And so we're going to have to recap for things that people have missed or forgotten mm-hmm. or ignored. Apparently they're paying attention to, you know, driving or kids in the back seat or whatever. So
right.
We're going to go over some of the principles that we've talked about, just some basic things that you can use to protect yourself in the future. First of all, err on the side of caution. Be an optimistic pessimist, meaning you'll hope for things to get better, but you assume that they're not going to be. You should cut your known expenses. Those are generally income taxes and investment fees, and in some cases, interest costs, but not always. Keep things as simple as you possibly can. Especially right now, cash is king, meaning paying off debt. Many people in the middle of a financial crisis want to pay off debt so they can stop the interest charges from affecting them even more. That's the exact wrong thing to do in most cases. Keep your cash on hand and then make the minimum payments just to kind of keep the ball in the air, if you will. If you're working in saving, you probably not only need the higher return of the stock market, but you can also afford the risk. If you are retired, you probably don't need the higher return, but you probably also can't afford the risk.
Well, let's start with those of us who are working. What should working people be doing?
Okay, a couple of crucial steps. We mentioned about cutting taxes wherever possible. If you have a 403B, a 401K, or even an IRA eligibility that you're not maximizing, you should try to ramp up your contributions to that, at least to get you to the 15% federal income tax bracket. That number is on line 43 of the 1040, and it's $69,000 for joint filers, and half of that amount, $34,500, for single filers. And if you have any more money left over and you qualify after you get down below that 15% bracket, then you should go to Roth IRAs for you and your spouse if you're married. You should get a new mortgage. You should get a new mortgage for 30 years with a fixed rate, and you should repay that as slowly as possible. And if you can't stomach the new mortgage, you should at least open a home equity line of credit if you have equity in your home. Finally, you should borrow money for big purchases, but keep cash on hand in a commensurate amount of the big purchase. So let's say you say, I need a car and I need to come up with $20,000 and I have $20,000 in my checking account. You should still try to get the loan first, but then leave the $20,000 in your checking account. One of the big mistakes people are making right now is they're still worried about, well, if I leave that money in my checking account, I'm paying 5% interest on the loan and I'm only earning 1%. The interest spread is not going to to be the thing that damages most people who fall into trouble. It will actually be the lack of liquidity to get money when they need it. And if you have the money, you can make the payments and, again, keep the ball in the air.
And for those who are retired?
Generally, you should get what you can while you can. Again, and this is, sounds like almost heresy to some people, but after working through it with several dozen homeowners over the last several years, you should get a new mortgage, and again, or at least get the home equity line of credit. You should generally take Social Security and pension payments sooner rather than later and leave as much of your savings intact for future needs as you possibly can. Certificates of deposit, FDIC-insured CDs, beat almost all other forms of income investments like bond mutual funds. And finally, in retirement, one of the great gifts is that you can manage your income to a great degree. You can decide when to take Social Security or your pension or withdrawals from your IRAs. And so you should manage your income, not so much about growing it, but about reducing your taxes to whatever extent you can.
So what kind of general advice do you have, Kevin, for those who want or need to be invested in the stock market but are puzzled over which funds or methods to use?
I think this is, we've been trending in this direction for a long time, but I've never felt more strongly about this. If you really like, you know, going to the Wall Street Journal site, reading Morningstar, studying up on day-to-day movements in different funds and stocks, great, go ahead and do that. But unlike many other endeavors in life, paying more attention to your money does not make it more likely that you will make more money. It usually makes it more likely that you're going to get caught up in the short-term day-to-day movements and make a big mistake. If you find yourself in that category, or you're just the kind of person that says, well, I really don't want to monkey around with this stuff, and you do say, I want to be in the stock market, take a look at target date mutual funds. These are generally mutual funds that have some combination of stock funds, bond funds, and money markets. And you pick a date in the future, say 2020. And as 2020 comes near over the next 8.5 years, the portfolio generally becomes more conservative. And it's not so much that that's some kind of fantastic market-beating philosophy, but it's a philosophy. And in times of trouble, it gives you something to stick to. You say, look, I know what I'm doing. I'm not going to need this money to 2020, so I'm going to just keep this on autopilot and keep myself from making a big mistake.
This is On Your Money. I'm Joy Cardine, along with financial planner Kevin McKinley. And let's take a call from Ralph in Little Suamico. Hello, Ralph.
Yes, hello. This is kind of a general question, but it's something that all the talk about AAA and AA and AA plus and the fact that, Standard & Poor's is lowered to, a triple or a AA plus. And what they say then is they say, well, then people are still investing in U.S. bonds because there's no place else to go with their money. And my question is, are there any such things as AAA ratings right now?
For investments, you mean?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. There are. There are a couple countries, including I think the Isle of Man is actually still has a AAA rating right now. And the United States still does, too, according to Moody's. According to Standard & Poor's, it's AA+. And keep in mind, this ratings business, not only did Standard & Poor's make a $2 trillion error in their initial calculation, but Standard & Poor's also had an awful lot of what were basically junk bonds rated AAA during the lead-up to the mortgage crisis. Mm-hmm. So this is just one agency's opinion of the current conditions of the United States. It's like rating a person's physical attractiveness a 10, and then you say, you know what, I saw him or her recently. They look like they gained a couple pounds. They're not a 10 anymore. They're a 9. And other people might still think that person is a 10, and it's just an agency's opinion. Now, it's not good, but it's not something that no one expected. It's not something that can't go back to a AAA, although the work might it might take longer to get back up to the AAA than it did to get down to a AA+. And again, it's really a comment on the political issues, not the economic strife going on. The economic strife has basically always been there and will be for the foreseeable future. It's more of an issue to say, gosh, you know, the grown-ups can't settle this in a civil manner. And they took, you know, keep in mind, as bad as the downgrade is, there were several people in positions of power who were comfortable pushing the U.S. to the brink of default a couple weeks ago, which would have been much worse than a slight downgrade from AAA to AA+.
Thank you, Ralph, for the call. Coming up after 9 o'clock, by the way, Kathleen Dunn and her guest will also be taking a look at the latest economic news, from the stock market's reaction to the credit downgrade to European instability to the possibility of a double-dip recession, coming up after 9 o'clock this morning. I'm Joy Cardine, along with Kevin McKinley. If you have a question for Kevin, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
My bills are all due, and the baby needs shoes, and I'm busted.
You're listening to On Your Money on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine, along with financial planner Kevin McKinley. And Kevin, we talked about saving and investing during these troubled or uncertain economic times in our last segment. Now let's talk a little bit about how much we should be spending during these uncomfortable financial conditions. What do you think?
Well, when people come to me and say, you know, I want you to look at my finances and analyze how I'm doing, if am I in good shape or not, I certainly look at all kinds of different aspects about, you know, how much cash they have, where their investments are, et cetera. But the key factor in anyone's financial independence, whether they're working or retired or somewhere in between, is how much money they spend every single month. And the people who are either financially independent or on their path to be so generally not only know what that is, but they track it on a month-to-month basis so they can see any changes that might lead to bigger problems down the road. Again, our special On Your Money financial independence factor is to retire independently. You need to take your monthly expenses, subtract any guaranteed payments like Social Security or pension payments, and then multiply the remaining amount by about 200. And if you have that amount of cash on hand, then you are financially independent. Now, some expenses just can't be cut, or it's too devastating to do it. But there are a lot of other things out there that you can cut, so it's important to figure out what that is and then reduce what you can.
Now, where do you see the best options to cut or to reduce spending?
After mortgages and property taxes and taxes, then it comes down to discretionary payments. And I see a lot of people say, you know, we're not saving as much as we should. And when I look at their spending, every single item on there made sense individually. But when you put it all in the aggregate, they say, gosh, I can't believe we spent $1,000 eating out yesterday. Or I went to Target six times in a month and we spent $800 on things that we probably could have either foregone or bought at a less expensive option. So it's usually eating out, it's entertainment, shopping, and then finally, and this is something that's hard to avoid, but we'll be discussing it again, grocery shopping. Many Americans are spending at least $100 to $200 in a given week, and that adds up to $5,000 to $10,000 a year.
Yeah, but I bet many people feel like they're already scaling back, perhaps in those areas. Is there anything else they can do to cut their spending even more?
A couple different ways, and we mentioned one before, which I think is really effective, and that is if you are working and you do have a pre-tax retirement savings plan like a 401k or TSA or 403b, try ramping up the contribution because you're still only paying yourself. You're not giving the money to someone else. It feels like that, but you're really just moving it over into an account that has your name on it, and for every dollar you get into a plan like that, you are probably cutting your income taxes by anywhere from 20 to 40 cents. Now, when you're talking about discretionary spending, the key to cutting that is to give yourself an allowance and give it to yourself in cash. So if you start the week and you say, I have $100 of what I would call allowed expenses coming up this week, give yourself $100 and try to avoid using plastic. Only take cash to the store. If you go to the grocery store with an $80 budget and you've got $80 in the form of 420s, I can guarantee if you leave your plastic in the car, you are only going to spend $80, no more. And finally, try to turn off the computer. Avoid any online purchases if you can, because sometimes it's just too easy to click, and you find yourself, you know, many online sites are designed specifically not only to make it easy to buy things, but to easy to buy more. And so sometimes you end up spending a lot more money by buying online than you would if you were to have to go out to the store and purchase it in person.
Yeah. But Kevin, what if somebody says, you know, been there, done that, there's no more fat for me to cut, no more room to cut expenses?
then your only other option is to increase your income. And we're actually going to talk in a few weeks about the best way to try to get a raise or to try to increase your income at your job. But many people, especially people in our parents' generation and grandparents' generation, thought nothing of working extra jobs or trying to earn money some other place to help augment their income. And if you have the time, and especially if you have more time than money, it can be a great way to make a difference. And it can be babysitting, it can be cleaning, it can be helping with yard work. If you're good at tools, a lot of people need trustworthy work done for home improvement right now. You can make money if you have a car, driving people around who can't drive for themselves, or checking on an older person. You know, many people in their 80s and 90s live far away from their children and their grandchildren. And there are people out there who would pay a trustworthy, decent person to go just check on an older person and say, are you doing okay? You know, are you eating? Are you in good condition? Kind of be the eyes and ears of the family when the family can't do it. You can put an ad on Craigslist for it. You can talk around your neighbors and let them know that, you know, you're interested in doing those things. And increasing your income is sometimes is a lot easier than even cutting your spending anymore.
I'm Joy Cardine along with Kevin McKinley. You're listening to On Your Money on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And time now for some calls for Kevin. And Scott in Hammond is with us. Hello, Scott.
Hi. A few calls back, somebody mentioned their child had gotten a gift of some money. Are there different rules for a child who earns some money, say 13, 14, 15-year-old who earns some money, might want it for college at some point? But what are the options?
It's a good question, Scott. What I was hoping is you were saying you were thinking about buying some storage units and wanted to know if you thought the price you were offering was fair and anybody who was selling it. Great question, Scott. One thing I would definitely look at for any teenager who has any earned income at all is using that income for the basis for a contribution to a Roth IRA for that kid. They just have to have legitimate earned income. The kid can be any age, but it has to be real income. You can't pay them to sit and play the Xbox. They have to be mowing lawns or babysitting or doing some kind of odd job or working at a fast food restaurant. And the kid can even spend his or her money, and you can actually use your own money to make the contribution. Now, it is a gift to the kid. But the neat thing about the Roth IRA is usually if you get $1,000 in now, if you can get, say, a 7% return, that money can grow by 30 to 50 times by the time the kid is ready to retire. It not only can grow and provide some tax-free retirement security, but you can always pull the contribution back out whenever you want with no taxes or penalties. And generally, most federal financial aid forms do not count kids' retirement accounts as an asset when they are figuring out financial aid. So it's a really good way to get them thinking about saving money for retirement, and especially when you show them, you know, go online and get a calculator and say, look, if we put $1,000 aside now, it might not be a whole lot in a year or 2 years from now. But when you're old like me, it'll be a lot of money, and it'll be a lot of money even with inflation for it. And I've seen many kids do that over the starting in their teen years, and it fosters a culture of saving that really helps protect them once they get into their 20s and 30s.
Scott, thanks very much for the call, and good luck to you. Tom in Oshkosh is with us now. Hello, Tom.
Good morning. I have a question. I have quite a bit of money in CDs. I'm retired, and I don't want to take any risks. I want to preserve the capital. Of course, the payout is not very good. But I've noticed I got a recommendation on the Vanguard Managed Payout Funds, which can pay a lot more than CDs. There's three different levels on it. Are you familiar with that vehicle? Does that sound like a good way to go to enhance what you've got in savings instead of using CDs?
I wouldn't say enhance. I would say complement is probably a better way to use those if you were to use them at all. I don't mind them, but you need to understand that just because they're managing the payout, it doesn't mean that the value won't rise and fall. I mean, CDs will even rise and fall in value depending on many factors. But the managed payout ones, what they purport to do is say, well, we're going to invest this money for you, and then we're going to pay you what we feel is a sustainable rate. It might be, you know, 4 or 6% of the money, say, on a yearly basis, and then we're going to try to manage it accordingly. I wouldn't look at them in the same light or the same eye as CDs. I would look at them something that is, it does offer more potential reward, but also offers more potential risk. I still love CDs and certificates of deposit as kind of the bedrock of the foundation, especially for someone who's risk averse and retired.
Good advice. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Tom. Danny in Green Bay. Hello, Danny.
Hi, I'm calling on behalf of my girlfriend, so I'll make this really quick. One question she has is she has $21,000 in her 401k with a $4,000 in her general savings. Is that enough for a person at the age of 26?
Yeah, actually, that's pretty good. That's not a bad start at all. It doesn't, you know, a lot of people out here who are in their 50s and 60s would say, yeah, that's not that much money. That's more than a lot of people had at 26 and have at 26. A good rule of thumb is in your 20s, if you have 25 times your monthly expenses saved up in a retirement account or in your savings, by the time you reach 30, you're actually doing pretty well. 25 in your 20s, 50 in your 30s, 100 in your 40s, and hopefully 200 by the time you get out of your 50s. But that's a good rule of thumb. So if she's got, you know, say $25,000 and she's spending $2,000 a month, she's on her way. She's not quite there yet, but she's not 30 yet. So that's actually not bad at all. Good for her.
Okay, and the second question really quick is she has a $3,100 monthly income with $800 in debt. Should she be putting anything in the way of alternative saving or investing?
Is it just $800 in debt or $800 in payments?
I believe it's $800 in payments.
Okay. Depending on the interest rate, I'd probably lean towards having her pay that off. If it's mortgage money or even a car loan or a student loan, it's probably best to pay it off slowly. If it's credit card debt that gets up in the double digits, and especially if it's over 20%, she's probably better off putting money aside to pay that off rather than saving more for retirement.
So, Danny, was your girlfriend just a little shy, or was it a matter of not being able to call in on her own?
A little of both.
Sorry, did you have anything else, Danny, for your girlfriend?
No, anything else. I can send an email to him. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for calling.
I understand her shyness. I am very intimidated.
Yes, so. That's right. You are. I think we have time for Bill in Kenosha. Hello, Bill.
Hi. I'm 62 years old. My wife is 61. I plan on retiring next year. I've got like $200,000 in a 401k. She's got $65,000 in a CD IRA, I think it is. And we only owe about $16,000 in debt. Our house is paid off. What do I need to do? What steps do I need to do? Especially what do I do with her money and my 401k, you know, to get it out of the company or... You know, to have some kind of income source or capital preservation or something.
Yeah, I would say a couple of things. First of all, the screeners are right, Joy. We will always prioritize callers who have names associated with anything financial and money.
That's
like
right.
Bill, Penny, cash. If there is cash out there, we'll definitely take a cash. I'd say a couple things. First of all, you're thinking along the right lines already, Bill, about preserving this and hanging on. It's hard enough to think about retiring. It's harder to think about retiring and then all of a sudden watching your money go down 20 or 30% over the matter of a few weeks when you've, you know, basically told your boss to technically take the job and shove it. So a couple things I would do. I would try to roll that money again over into CDs and the IRA and not worry so much about growth right now. Just worry about preserving what you have. Second of all, I would open up a home equity line of credit on that home to make sure that you've got some access to a cash that you can get at when you need it without reapplying for a mortgage. And third, I would have you probably take Social Security sooner rather than later. I'd rather have you get that money and some income that really can serve as an effective bridge from working to retirement and then still preserve the savings that you do have for an emergency or if interest rates go up. It'd be nice to be able to roll that into a higher yielding CD so you could get a better return off of it.
We were kind of planning on taking our Social Security at the same time when I'm 63 and she's 62 next year at this time to maximize the what we get.
And I'm afraid we don't have time for just a yes or no for that, Kevin.
Yes or no?
There we go.
Oh, right.
We'll have to, Bill, I'm sorry, we're out of time for that follow-up. Website of the week, though, Kevin, we have time, just 30 seconds for that.
TaxFoundation.org has a new calculator out that helps you calculate your effective tax rates, which are going to be in a very important financial issue for people going forward. We'll have a link up to that website at our website, onyourmoney.com, later on today.
And four more words before we go.
Spend less, have more.
Kevin McKinley, certified financial planner, managing member of McKinley Money, LLC. Kevin will be off next week. I'm sure he's not actually on a vacation. He never takes vacation, but he will be off next week, and we'll talk with him the Tuesday after that. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network.